Be to order. It is Wednesday, May 4th, 2022. It's 1:08 p.m. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Talia Ames from the Juneau LAO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, right now, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Drummond, and myself, Representative Klayman. We do not require a quorum to conduct our business today. And our first order of business today is House Bill 5, Sexual Assault, Definition of Consent, sponsored by Representative Tarr. This is the seventh hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Today we're taking invited testimony. We're joined today by Professor Kimberly Kessler-Ferzan, Professor of Law and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania Carey School of Law. She is with us on Teams. Professor Ferzan, if you would identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Great. Good afternoon. I am Kimberly Kessler-Ferzan. I'm the Earl Hepburn Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. I've written several articles on sexual assault, and I serve as an advisor to the American Law Institute's Model Penal Code Sexual Assault Reform Project. My views are my own and do not represent those of the ALI. I wanted to speak for a few moments about the complexities of criminalizing sexual assault and some of the choices the April 28th draft bill makes. I will speak generally about what consent is, why we need to distinguish assent from consent, and how factors that may defeat consent are understood in the draft. First, what is consent? Assuming there is no coercion, deception, or incapacity, something I'll return to later, what does one person have to do to make it permissible for another person to have sex with them? We could have a provision that said just only words will do. For example, yes. You could require in a statute a yes through either words or actions. Or a statute could require words and actions, but also allow inferences from inactions as well. This is familiar in the sort of question at a board meeting. If no one objects, then the minutes are approved. That would be inaction showing consent. And some empirical evidence seems to indicate that many people do consent in this sort of way. Finally, you could think of consent just as willingness or an internal choice. If I see my neighbor crossing my lawn and I think that's okay with me, he is no longer trespassing. My own personal scholarly view is that this is the correct way to think about what consent really is, that if we are respecting my autonomy, then I can change others' rights and duties simply by what I choose to allow to do. Now, the draft bill has willingness in it, and I think this can be understood in two different ways. One as adopting the internal act view, where how someone behaves gives us evidence of this internal choice or this internal willingness. Or it may be that words and actions allow inferences from silence. So either one way is that silence is evidence that the person is saying yes in their head, or the other way is that someone can say yes simply by silence. But I take it there will be no practical difference between these two when it actually comes to cases. Now, some feminists would argue a words and action standard that requires more should be put in place. And let me explain that sort of argument. You have defined sexual assault in the second degree to include sexual penetration without consent. Given Alaska's provision for default mental states, this means that the defendant will ultimately have to be reckless as to the lack of consent. That is, he or she must consciously disregard a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the victim is not consenting. So let's say the victim does not resist and allows the defendant to continue. She later says she was experiencing frozen fright, and he says he took her acquiescence as consent. As long as he believes she was consenting, he's not guilty because he's not reckless. Even if you drop the mental state to negligence, if a reasonable person would believe there was consent, because reasonable people often take consent to be evidenced by passivity, he's still not guilty. So to protect victims and change social norms, some advocates argue for affirmative consent standards, thereby requiring words and actions. The biggest problem with doing this is that you're trying to shift behavior without really giving anyone notice of it. It becomes a trap for the unwary because ignorance of the law is not a defense. It's easy to shift norms with college kids because you can force them to go to orientation and tell them what's required, but shifting social norms more generally is difficult. And so you have to ask, do we want to punish people with severe felonies to change how people consent to sex? And remember, this applies not just to inexperienced first-timers, but to those in long-term relationships as well. A second concern about affirmative consent standards is that it's extremely hard to articulate what counts as communicating yes, and it can potentially invite the very kind of dissection of the victim's behavior that affirmative consent standards aim to avoid. What kind of behavior by the victim, what words and conduct count as saying yes? Finally, with an affirmative consent standard, more onus is put on defendants. If you think about how affirmative consent would be shown, it would come closer to requiring a defendant to convince a jury that he had consent than the state to require its absence. There is then the question whether it is fair to punish someone if the state has not shown lack of consent beyond a reasonable doubt. For these reasons, I would leave the draft's willingness formulation in place. Frankly, if I had my druthers, I might choose decision, choice, or willed acquiescence to better distinguish consent from mere desires, but willingness is tracking the current model penal code draft. Here is a second question about consent that impacts drafting. Consent is conceptually confusing because we use this one word to mean two things. Sometimes we mean this an internal or external act that counts as a yes, and sometimes we mean the internal or external act plus sufficient conditions of freedom, knowledge, and capacity. Okay, so some cases simply lack the internal or external yes. So having sex with a comatose person doesn't involve an internal or external yes. In other cases, though, the person does say yes, but it doesn't count. So a 12-year-old's enthusiastic yes to sexual contact doesn't count. So too, someone who says yes at the point of a gun doesn't count as making the action permissible. Some people would say there isn't consent in this latter sort of cases, but we also in our ordinary language say she consented at gunpoint or the teenager consented, and this makes things tricky. Because the model penal code and the way that the ALI goes about approving provisions locked in the definition of consent as willingness, it then had to use the term effective consent elsewhere. The draft, likewise, your draft, likewise defines consent as willingness and then says consent is ineffective if induced by fraud, duress, or deception. This means you're making the decision to say that the 12-year-old does consent, but not effectively. An alternative would be to say that assent is willingness and consent is assent without any of the undermining conditions. So why does this matter? Well, first, you might notice that there's double duty for consent in your use of force provision, where you criminalize sex, quote, without consent of that person by the use of force or the express or implied threat of force. Notice this will cover both the person who is not saying yes at all and is compelled, and the person who says yes, but only because of a gun. But really, a person who says yes at a point of a gun is willing. It's just that it isn't effective. So this provision arguably equivocates in terms of what you mean by consent. Although you might expect that courts will interpretively gloss this as you'd like, it isn't quite as precise of what consent means. The model penal code, again, faces similar problems because consent is willingness. They have to back out of it by saying the act is without effective consent because the actor uses or explicitly or implicitly threatens to use physical force. So many of us thought that this was clunky drafting, that if the consent is ineffective when there is force, then you only need to discuss force, not the consent, because the consent doesn't count anyway. You just want that a person submits or is compelled by force. The without consent language actually does no work. So now consider how the draft deals with defeaters like force, fraud, and fraud more generally. First, it's not clear how you want the specific defeaters that you mention in the statute, accepts when a person is under threat of force or is lied to about a medical procedure, and how you want the provision to square that with the provision that consent is ineffective if it's induced by force, duress, or deception. The Model Penal Code only has the very provisions that it defines specifically count as the ones that undermine consent through force, fraud, or incapacity. To see why this matters, assume that Bob lies to Alex and Alice and tells her that he loves her and she has sex with him because of that. Under your very limited statutory provisions, it seems as though Alice was not sexually assaulted because you have not spelled out that kind of lie. But under your provision that consent is ineffective if it's induced by force, duress, or deception, she may not consent, and so Bob would be guilty of sexual assault in the second degree. That is your provision about ineffective consent, which doesn't specify when it is ineffective, could be construed broadly. Indeed, if the way deception is defined elsewhere in your code is used here, Bob would be guilty of second degree sexual assault. This would make Alaska a significant outlier in the kinds of cases that jurisdictions punish for deception. All kinds of lies would then count, including, for example, if a spouse lies and tells her partner that she is not sleeping with other men, if it is that representation that leads to continued marital sex. So I thank you for soliciting my views. I hope this is helpful, and I await your questions. I have a handful of other comments I could provide, but I know that this is what you wanted me to particularly focus on for today. So thank you.
Questions for members of the committee? Representative Drummond. I meant to say Representative Vance joined us at about 1:15, 1:16.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Professor Ferzan, for joining us. You mentioned a term that I had a hard time understanding. It sounded like defeaters. Can you please explain what that is? I am not a lawyer.
Sure, apologies.
Few of us on this committee, except for the chair. And it's difficult to understand some of your terms.
I apologize. So all I meant by defeaters is that the idea that when someone says yes, sometimes it's not enough to count. And so when you're saying that a yes that's compelled by force doesn't count as a yes, or a yes when somebody is deceived doesn't count as a yes, then I'm just using those kinds of situations where the yes doesn't count as defeaters of consent, right? They're the things where even if you have the yes, if one of those is present, we're not going to say that it's morally effective in making it permissible for the person to go forward, right? So a yes at gunpoint, the gun defeats the consent that you would otherwise have.
Understood. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if we could have the professor send her testimony, because she seemed to be reading from it, and that would help me in my thought process.
Let me ask Professor Ferzan, were they written remarks, or you're just kind of, are they written or not written?
They are written, and I am happy to email them to you.
Thank you very much. We'll distribute that to the committee. Other questions, Representative Eastman?
Thank you. You know, I think your point was very well made earlier when you talked about trying to shift behavior using laws and how that can be problematic as far as the variety of information or level of information that members of the public have. And you mentioned specifically the college student exception to that. And I'm remembering that there were some colleges that took a very proactive approach to affirmative consent, and I remember hearing about one college in particular that wanted you to specifically affirmatively consent to every specific physical act, and so in one intimate encounter you might have an unlimited number effectively of requirements for that affirmative consent. And it seemed like you had a little bit of knowledge on the college sort of application of that. Do you have data? Did that approach work well? Is that something that you're familiar with, or can you speak to that perhaps?
So I'll start with saying I do not have data. I know that most, I guess I would say that it is my understanding that most colleges do have stronger affirmative consent standards. Sometimes they even want things like enthusiastic consent. where they are really pushing college students to more forcefully articulate sexual desire than to be passive in those situations. I think there is some question about whether college students actually do that. I'm not sure that we have recent studies on that, but at least I am not aware of what those studies are. I just know that when I get the law students, I find that there are some students who went to colleges that were absolutely positively indoctrinated in this kind of conception of consent, and other students who had no exposure to this kind of consent. And so the sort of assumption of everyone knows that the only way to consent is in this affirmative sort of way is actually not the experience even of students at top law schools.
Thank you. A follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
Through the chair, I'm curious, and feel free to say if you don't have a response, that's fine. But, you know, I'm trying to sort of ascertain as a lawmaker where Alaska falls in terms of the spectrum of embracing some of these more contemporary concepts dealing with consent. And it's somewhat challenging for me to figure out how to answer that question. I'm just, you mentioned that, you know, in the adoption of this particular draft of legislation, Alaska would be an outlier. And I'm just, aware of one of two things? One, you know, where Alaska falls currently compared to other states, or how a legislator like myself might be able to find out, where people in my state kind of stand as far as the consent, because I have the written statute to look at. I can see that, but that doesn't tell me to what extent that statute, even if it's been longstanding, has been embraced by the public, short of, you know, trying to figure out how many prosecutions are taking place.
So let me just clarify where Alaska would or wouldn't be an outlier first, which is that it's specifically in the way that deception might be understood that you would be taking an extraordinarily bold stance. If it really is the kind of exception where sort of any lie or misrepresentation, I'm actually looking at a different part of the Alaska Code. The representative Plamen sent to me that deception can be knowingly creating or confirming false impressions, including intentions or other states of mind, or failing to correct another's false impression. You could wind up with extraordinarily broad lies counting, including I love you, as sexual assault. And jurisdictions tend to be pretty nervous about expanding it that far. I am not an exact head counter on these things, but I think it's fair to say that typically you only get deceptions that relate to, I thought it was a medical treatment and it wasn't, or I thought it was my spouse or someone known to me and it wasn't. And typically jurisdictions don't want to get in the business of policing which kinds of lies count to undermine consent. So if you were to, rely on deception as you use it elsewhere in the code, you would wind up clearly being an outlier. Now, in terms of the definition of consent, my sense is that jurisdictions are all over the place, from ones that are using affirmative consent standards to ones that are using willingness. And this is an ever-changing landscape. In terms of figuring out where everyone stands, actually, the best bet would be to get one of the draft ALI. If you go onto the ALI website, some of the versions of the draft, although the Model Penal Code, the new revision, hasn't been approved, some of the drafts are up there. And those reporters had law students who did, hours and hours and days of research. And it does, they frequently provide the breakdown of how different jurisdictions are dealing with different things. And the consent question was actually highly contested, and even contested in terms of what was going on the ground versus what was going on in the statutes.
And just by way of background, Representative Eastman, I had sent the professor It's Alaska Statute 11.81.900, subsection B has a definition of consent in the general definitions in the criminal code. And I think that's either four or five part definition of deception.
Thank you.
Because we'd heard from Legislative Legal Services that in the provisions that's in the committee substitute that references forced duress or deception, their perspective was that they would look to the general definition of deception for purposes of what it means in this proposed statute.
Thank you. That,
yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, through the chair. And I'm all for bold action when it's appropriate, and I don't mind necessarily, being an outlier if it's in the right direction. But I'm wondering, what are some of the harms that you're aware of that might happen in if we were to take this bold approach in defining deception this way?
I think it's a matter of whether you really want every single lie to constitute sexual assault anytime it's essentially material to the victim. So someone's religion, someone's their job, someone's affection. I think the worry for the drafters of the MPC was that it really would turn a lot of adultery into potentially sexual assault, because anytime there's an assurance that there's no one else, that would in fact then future sex within the marriage would be based on that false impression and would otherwise not have happened. So, and then it also can potentially get courts into the business of whether or not you want to apply this to beliefs that you find, potentially against public policy. So assume that someone has, in fact, been sexually assaulted in the past, and someone says, Alice has been sexually assaulted, and Bob says, I only want to have sex with my wife, who's a virgin, and she doesn't disclose this because she believes it's highly personal. Does that mean that Alice has now sexually assaulted Bob? And do you want courts in the business of policing the kinds of lies that, in fact, are or are not sort of private and really only, in some sense, the defendant's business? I mean, it certainly comes up in terms of potentially race, religion. Certainly, trans persons are going to implicate the question of whether or not disclosure or lying about disclosure would matter. Right. So there's just some questions about what kinds of false impressions could, in fact, count as deception under this statute.
Thank you, Paula.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you also, through the chair. Now, under the current language that we're looking at here, dealing with deception, would failure to disclose the presence of an STD be counted as deception? Or would that simply be sort of a personal choice to disclose that or not to disclose that prior to an intimate encounter?
So to the extent that it says create or confirm another's false impression that the defendant doesn't believe to be true, and then it says including, so I suppose the question would be whether or not this has been interpreted that only these provisions count, or whether any kind of lie that in fact is a false impression the person doesn't believe to be true would in fact count under these provisions. I'd actually have to see a little bit how Alaska fully interprets that statute. There have been times that people have put into, or have been times people put into, you certainly could, if you were worried about STDs, put that in separately as a kind of deception. What courts tend to do with these cases is that jurisdictions will have that you deceive somebody as to the nature and quality of the act. So this is the kind of case where someone thinks that they're consenting to a medical procedure, but it turns out that it's, actually a body part. And what courts will do is they'll then say, well, instead of it just being sex that you had to be consenting to. You had to be consenting to sex without an STD. And so they try and make the act that's being defined, instead of just being sex, being, you know, disease-free sex. And that's the way that they interpretively try to gloss it, even if it's not specifically in the statute.
Thank you very much. I don't want to hog the mic, so I'll sit back.
I've got a couple of questions that I had. First is that you were talking earlier about our use in the draft bill of willingness, and that was a change from the freely given concept that was in an earlier version of the bill. Can you, what's your, in the use of the language of the freely given language versus the willingness language, do you have a perspective on kind of the pros and cons of both of those options? And I'm particularly interested in which tends to be more protective of victims, particularly in light of rape shield laws.
So freely given, as it was defined, is an agreement to cooperate in the act was positively expressed by word or action. So it's interesting. I would have thought that freely given was just picking up things like it wasn't under force or fraud or duress, and so it wasn't doing a lot of work that you didn't have going on somewhere else in the statute. But the way that this earlier draft defined freely given, you actually are requiring affirmative consent through here. You're making, you're requiring that the, I guess victim, although not victim, if the person positively, right, basically said through words or actions. That goes back to the earlier part of my testimony where I think it is going to be more victim protective. Because there can't be, you know, if you're looking for something that's basically a yes, right, that somebody has to, there are fewer mistakes that you can make about what in particular passivity can mean in those kinds of cases. And that does protect victims. That being said, and you're right to kind of raise the rape shield question, I've always wondered, once we're looking not at what's going on in the victim's mind, like, is the victim really willing? Is this the thing she's wanted or chosen or decided? But whether or not she's expressed something, then you're really looking kind of external to her at what her conduct was in ways that yield this. She said yes, either by saying the words yes, but more likely through, well, the way she was leaning on me, the way she took off her clothes, you know, and this is what led me to believe it was a yes. And so you could wonder whether or not that actually winds up being better for victims in the way that their conduct gets scrutinized as actually evincing yes, not as I was mistaken, right? I really thought when she leaned on me that she thought yes, but these things are just good enough to count as yes. And so it is generally thought by feminists to be more, the freely given, as you define it, is thought to be more protective of victims. But I think there are many of us who wonder whether in practice, that kind of scrutiny with that particular question really does help victims as much as we may think it does.
And specifically in comparison to the willingness definition?
So the willingness definition, to the extent that you're saying, to the extent that what this means is somebody's willing because they've chosen in their head, right? It just means that there's more potential for defendants in some ways to get it wrong and then to be found not guilty, right? So the passive person, right? When the victim is passive, you could think one of two things. One, people sometimes consent really by just not stopping someone. Or two, somebody's passive because they don't like what's going on. They don't want to consent. Maybe they believe their passivity is showing this, or right, they feel as though the person they're with has been so aggressive that they somewhat shut down instead of saying no or resisting in any particular way. So if passivity can mean yes or no, then if the defendant can say, well, I took that passivity as a yes, the defendant will be found not guilty under the provisions that you have because he will not have consciously disregarded the risk that she's not consenting. He thinks passivity equals yes, and so his culpability is lacking, even if it's true that she really wasn't consenting. And so the more you require external manifestations and say that's the thing you've got to get, the fewer mistakes that we're letting defendants make. And that is, and if you can change norms, right? If you know, to go back to the old Antioch provisions, if people always said yes, right, you would have far fewer mistakes about, in fact, whether people were consenting, right? But it, in fact, is shifting the norms of our behavior to try and make sure that we aren't sometimes sort of exculpating defendants when they, in fact, get it wrong.
So just it's curious, and I'll go another area that I had questions about. We heard, I think I told you before, that Professor Buell from Duke Law School testified to us a week or so ago, and on the same question, he leaned more towards the model penal code use of willingness as the consent concept rather than the freely given. And his perspective was that the willingness was more protective of victims than the freely given concept. And always good to know that in the academic world, one doesn't always get uniformity. The second question, because you testified quite a lot in the draft that we're looking at on page 4, it's line 17 that references consent is ineffective if induced by forced duress or deception, which we've actually been talking about quite a lot. That provision is really not part of the model penal code structure. I think the first 4 sections are largely tracking parts of the model penal code structure. Is your perspective that fifth part, consent is ineffective if induced by forced duress or deception, is your perspective that we should consider removing that language going forward, or is this a concept that maybe needs to be altered or definitions changed? What's your sense in terms of going forward with the bill that we have in front of us on that specific line? Because I hear criticism in what you're saying that we're probably going a little further than we intended, but I'm curious your feedback on how to approach that.
So I think you could probably strike it, but the other thing to do is simply to say consent is ineffective if induced by forced duress or deception as defined in, and then give the earlier provisions where you're talking about the kinds of force and deception and duress that in fact undermine consent. And that means that, right, so that your sort of first provision, right, the person engages in sexual penetration without consent by the use of force or express or implied use of force is what's going to be what renders consent ineffective. Otherwise, you have, and I didn't talk specifically about this, but even something like duress, and you may know sort of how Alaska is going to potentially key into Alaska's provision, but you could ask questions like, well, if there's differences in power and structure and the situation, should that count as duress? And so all of a sudden you have all kinds of other areas of the code or all kinds of other interpretive questions where you're going to be punishing someone potentially, right, for it's a second degree felony, class B felony, sexual assault in the second degree, which I believe is up to 10 years if I've done my research correctly, based on sort of these unknown pockets. So my inclination would be that anything that you want to say undermines or defeats the yes needs to be specified exactly in the code provisions. And then you can either refer back to those or in that ineffective line, or you can just get rid of that ineffective line because you've already spelled out that a yes under these circumstances doesn't matter and the person's still liable to punishment.
I want to note briefly that Representative Kirka joined us at 1:40 p.m. Other questions from members of the committee? I may have more, but I don't want to hog the question lines. Representative Eastman, sound like you had a few more. I'll, I'll let you ponder that for a minute, and I'll get a different question. In the earlier versions of the bill, there was no grading of sexual assault where force was involved and where force wasn't involved. And so when the earlier versions of the bill, it pretty much made sexual assault without consent, whether induced by force or no force at all, they were both first-degree sexual assault. The most recent version is grading those so that first degree requires the use of force, second degree doesn't require the use of force, and there's a similar layering effect with sexual contact. What's your perspective on how other states are approaching that? Are there states that have made sexual assault with no force and with force identical, or is the general pattern to distinguish those two in terms of severity of the offense?
So I do not have the head counts at the ready. It's my general sense that typically force is graded more severely, and I would absolutely advocate for grading. If anything, I would potentially even have more layers of complexity as opposed to fewer. Without making light of any sexual assault, the way that Alaska defines recklessness can include somebody who's voluntarily intoxicated and therefore fails to appreciate a risk they otherwise would have been aware of. And so you have to ask the question whether or not you want to punish the person who becomes intoxicated and misreads signals and is therefore guilty of sexual assault without consent, whether that person you believe deserves as much punishment or even to be labeled or in the same category or eligible for the same kind of severity as the person who uses extraordinary force to accomplish the same thing or uses a gun. And at least to my mind, it seems to me that those things are in fact quite different. And that even questions about whether or not somebody is mentally incapable or incapacitated as a victim, and whether or not you want to recognize degrees of blameworthiness on the part of the defendant, given how terrible we think these different offenses are, I would urge at least the two, if not more, just as we distinguish murder from mayhem, from aggravated assault, from simple assault, recognizing that all of these are invasions of somebody's bodily integrity, but they can be more or less serious.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I want to zero in for a moment, not on the issue of force itself, but in the draft, we have the language, the implied threat of force. And I'm curious, sort of what are the competing approaches to addressing the issue? If someone is trying to threaten you without using words, I think they're trying to threaten you, and the law should consider that a threat. Certainly the person receiving it is probably considering that a threat. I'm picturing, someone, pulling out brass knuckles and just sort of, putting them on their fingers or something, which isn't necessarily saying they're going to beat you up, but probably communicates something pretty close to that. But I'm also, since implications are somewhat vague and ambiguous and sometimes misunderstood, I'm also wanting to know, how do other states or are there some model ways of capturing that? Is this one of those? And if someone says, he looked at me and there was murder in his eyes, the person receiving that, is receiving the threat, but I think it might be hard from a prosecution standpoint to be able to demonstrate that a particular look really was this implied threat of force that we're trying to capture.
Just for reference, we're talking about the language on page 1 and page 2 of the bill that specifically talks about use of force or the express or implied threat of force against the person.
So I can at least say that the current model penal code draft is also using the implied use of force. So I take it that there's two questions you could have about this. One is, you know, how do we prove after the fact through what the victim says that something constitutes implied force, right? Where in fact she'd have to get on the stand and say there was something about how he was standing, this, that, and the third thing that in fact scared me. And the other side is, should we be worried that defendants are going to be swept up in this because the victim takes it to be a threat of force when it's not? So on the latter, the mens rea provisions, the mental state provisions that sort of kick into the law are going to require that, in fact, I actually think it would be seen as a conduct. It will either be interpreted as a conduct or attendant circumstance. But all that is to say is either the defendant has to know, or he at least has to be consciously disregarding the risk that he's using force in that kind of case. So he has to understand that it will be taken that way before it counts as an implied use of force. So I believe one of the cases is a case where, you know, a woman is for some reason in a man's house, and then he says something about like checking out his firearms, and the way that he talks about the firearms leads her to believe that there's actually a threat of force going on in terms of the request for sex. So he has to actually have that mental state. If he truly doesn't understand that he is threatening, then it won't violate the statute. On the other side, it is, of course, always the sort of tricky thing for the state, which has to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt, to rely on the victim taking the stand and articulating fully what exactly happened that constituted the implied threat of force. But I'm not sure, at least off the top of my head, how you'd kind of unpack an implied threat of force so that you could sort of give more concrete guidance to a jury. In some ways, it really is just the understanding that in that particular circumstance, there really was a threat of physical harm that came along with words that didn't directly say it.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just need to confirm that if consent freely given is more protective of victims than willingness. I'm much more interested in protecting victims than defendants here, and I want to make sure that victims have as much opportunity as they can.
So you're just asking, so any time that you're requiring an affirmative consent standard, you are in fact... So my thought is the reason why we – let me back up and say this. It's obvious it's going to be an empirical question and could be different from one case to another of whether or not it winds up being in the victim's best interest that it's a words and action standard. What I don't like about it, and I'd actually be curious, I'll have to talk to Sam Buell afterwards. What I don't like about words and action is that it does lead to a tremendous amount of scrutiny of the victim's behavior for a not whether she really wanted something, but just whether or not the way she behaved by what she said and did counted as a yes. And I do think that there is a danger here for victims in a words and action because of the way it leads to victim scrutiny.
So if you can,
on the other,
can you clarify a little bit? So when you say words and action standard, You keep this going at a faster pace than some of us. When you say words and action standard, is that the freely given standard in the older version of the law, or is the free words and action standard the willingness standard in the current version that we're looking at?
It is the definition in the older standard. So if I'm looking at the older standard, page 6, subsection 9, consent means a freely given reversible agreement specific to the conduct at issue in this paragraph. Freely given means agreement to cooperate in the act was positively expressed by word or action. So
that's the word and action standard. Representative Drummond, do you want to see that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what CS she's looking at unless she tells me what version she's
got. That's the one she's got.
Okay. Hold on. Okay. You're just going to have to repeat yourself, Professor.
Page 6.
Page 6.
So it's line that two. Second line, consent. So I wanted to understand what the draft meant by freely given. And so it turns out that consent means a freely given reversible agreement specific to the conduct at issue in this paragraph. Freely given means agreement to cooperate in the act was positively expressed by word or action. So that means that the things that count as consent are going to be yes, absolutely, so, and any kinds of words that denote someone wants to have sex, or particular actions that likewise count as a yes. For example, taking off all of one's clothes and someone else's clothes and then proceeding to climb on top of them counts as action. The question then becomes, for victims under a standard like this, the potential downside is that when you're looking for agreement by scrutinizing victim behavior, is it always what kinds of things count, right? So clearly you're not going to want the fact that the victim was dressed scantily to count as an action that was expressing consent. But the victim was sitting on my bed and then she started kissing me. And all of a sudden, it's a lot of judgment about the way the victim behaves as constituting a yes. So that would be the downside of a standard like this. The upside of a standard like this is it just doesn't let true passive silence count as a yes. So to the extent, and I will borrow my ALI colleague, Michelle Dempsey's phrase, which is, you know, the worry is you shouldn't have sex with someone who is like a dead fish. To the extent that you don't want to allow a defendant to say, well, I thought there was consent when this person didn't say no, they, you know, were passive. That doesn't cut it under the freely given standard that you have, because it's not positive words and action. Instead, right, that would count as sexual assault. So it would require of defendants that they really get a yes, either through words or behavior, before they go forward, and silence would not be good enough. So in that respect, it is more protective of victims. Which way this cashes out kind of depends on how frequently defense attorneys are extremely nasty to victims on the stand, how many people really change their behavior in light of criminal statutes, right? So do we in fact shift the norm so that every time people are having sex, they're really saying yes by words or in action? And this is not just, again, two people meeting in a bar, but the law that will tell people, you know, who have been in 1 year, 2 year relationships, 3 month relationships, what it is that's legally required of them before they're allowed to have sex with each other.
Representative Drummond.
So there seems to be a significant amount of freezing on the part of victims. What is going to cover a victim who freezes and can't respond?
If you are worried about frozen fright, you want to go with the freely given standard. That is the standard that will, in fact, prohibit sex with someone who has not said yes or engaged in behavior that says yes.
Thank you.
Representative Vance, welcome to the question queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've just been reflecting on just the different degrees of sexual penetration that we have, and my concern is when there is sexual penetration without the use of force or implied threat of force. But for instance, maybe coercion is involved, of a threat of revealing some, you know, something to the public or something like that. Does this bill address those instances to be classified as rape?
From my review of it, I do not believe that it does. So the way the model penal code dealt with it was to have an entirely different section in terms of the kinds of things that count as coercion that were not force. So that would include things like threatening to deport someone or threatening someone that they won't graduate. Those cases aren't covered unless a jurisdiction were to adopt an extraordinarily broad view of force that would go beyond what you really typically think that it is. And I don't know, Alaska might have a definition of force somewhere else that would easily rule that out.
Follow up?
Representative Vance.
So instead of amending the definition that we have here by the use of force or the express or implied threat of force against any person, you recommend having an additional grading and section having to do with that wording?
I think that if you want to include other kinds of coercion, either by actually specifying clear rules about the kinds of things that are coercive, or by having a more general standard, like situations in which a person of reasonable firmness would yield, that you would then need an addition. I do think you'd need an additional provision to accomplish that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, a lot of the language in the bill currently deals with the act of sexual penetration, which, of course, it's got a very clear definition in statute. When the bill is passed, say it is passed, and we're dealing with a case of a prosecution for violating the bill, what should we expect, or what can you tell us with regard to, I gave, you know, affirmative consent to have sex, but not that, or not that kind of sex, or not that specific act that took place, because we have, you know, if all we're going by is the definition of sexual penetration, then that's very easy to understand, you know, yes or no. But certainly there are going to become cases in which, you know, an individual says, yes, I gave affirmative consent to sex, but then there's still a problem, and they don't look at that consent or do not consider that consent as carrying over to this particular thing that then happened.
So I think that's going to potentially be a little bit tricky. Given that you have consent is willingness to engage in the conduct at issue, technically, if something exceeds the bounds of either what the person was willing or what the person said yes to, the freely given by words or conduct, then technically it will be a violation, right? Because it's not as simple as I agreed to any sort of penetration or no penetration. It's going to be to specific conduct at issue, which will arguably be somewhat fine-grained. I mean, there are going to always be sort of gray area questions. I think it's hard to legislate around where it's slightly different than what one consents to. You know, to use a silly example, one consents to kissing, didn't really consent to the fact the person had bad breath, but you're stuck with the fact that you're kissing somebody with bad breath. And we don't fine grain it that much. So I am not sure that there's much more that sort of occurs to me that you would be able to do with this that isn't going to create some boundary problems. But I think most of this is handled by the fact that the person does, in fact, have to consent to the particular conduct that's at issue.
Thank you. And just for my clarification, the conduct at issue, which definition brings that into the mix?
That is the willingness definition in the April 28th draft.
Right.
And actually, it says in your other one, consent means a freely given reversible agreement specific to the conduct at issue. So it appears that both definitions are talking about conduct at issue, which should give you some structure to the content of that consent.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see any other questions. And
I do have one.
Okay. That's why I was going slow in case
people have a chance to. Professor, I'm just curious about how many states are using the phrase willingness. And do we know if that has any impact in terms of getting convictions?
So I think the answer to both of those questions is I don't know. I know that some states use willingness. I don't know the exact head count. I think sometimes even in statutes, they just use the word consent, and then it gets defined by case law. Where the ALI has had drafts on this, the reporters have done this sort of 50-state surveys, but I do not know that information off the top of my head. I think the problem about whether it impacts convictions is just that there are so many other hurdles for victims of sexual violence before one even gets to the substantive criminal law that prevent them from thinking that they should report, to police taking them seriously, to prosecutors coming forward, to juries believing them, that there is some skepticism about whether or not the substantive changes in the underlying criminal law is going to do a tremendous amount of work unless there are other changes that prevent victims from being able to comfortably come forward and be successful in their cases.
I don't see a follow-up. I actually want to return briefly. You were talking earlier in response to some questions about what's covered in the draft legislation, where we've taken for first degree sexual assault with penetration, there's the required use of force or implied use of force. And then in second degree sexual assault involving penetration without consent, but without the use of force, it's defined as basically everything without consent that isn't included in first degree. But you were talking about some level of conduct that might still not be covered as sexual assault in the second degree is penetration without consent. Can you go back to that and explain that a little bit in more detail?
I'm sorry, I don't actually know what.
It's okay. You were describing it had to do with duress type settings where somebody might have consented under circumstances that appear to be some kind of duress. And hence they haven't given affirmative consent in the way, whether it's by willingness or by the freely given definition, but they haven't given hasn't been consent. You had been talking about that under duress and stuff. And so I'm trying to track how that fits within the way this defines as first degree sexual assault involves consent coerced by, or consent through the use of force, and second degree that includes everything where force is not an issue. And I'm wondering, I think that, I know that's not I didn't fully end it with a question mark, but if you can comment on that.
Sure. So I think this just gets back to in this draft where you have consent is ineffective if induced by force, duress, or deception, what it is that you think that sentence is doing. So one thing is that there's just a whole other separate group of ways that one can, in fact, not have consent that are not specified here, and that are either going to be filled in by other statutes or by judges interpreting those provisions. Or what you mean is just that either the person has said, I'll just say, has said yes, but in fact, there's some condition that makes that yes ineffective for example, they're mentally incapable. So a person who's mentally incapable might say yes, but it doesn't count. And you have that clearly delineated as something that doesn't count. Or what would then be picked up under subsection 5, where it's sexual penetration without consent, is that very kind of victim who freezes kind of case. That would be a case if you have a freely given definition. So if you have a freely given definition and then the person freezes, then it's without consent. Or if you have a willingness definition and the victim says no. So there's a pretty standard case in Pennsylvania called Berkowitz where she says no. She doesn't do anything else to resist. And he has sex with her. That would also fall under this provision of without consent. And so it's just a question of whether you intend to capture very specified things and then just the person really isn't willing or hasn't said yes, or whether you want to pick up cases where someone's willing or has said the word yes, but there's something else wrong and lurking in the background that you think it makes it ineffective that you're otherwise not specifying in the statute.
But it sounds like, at least with respect to the draft we're looking at, paragraph 5, line 17 on page 4, that's a line that what I'm hearing from your testimony is that we're adding a lot of uncertainty and complexity with one sentence, that we either have to get a whole lot of definitions in to clarify that, or we should consider removing that subsection entirely and then recognize there may be other issues we may need to take up in the future. But at least for purposes of the core stuff we're trying to do with this bill, that one subparagraph may be adding a whole bunch of things that were unintended or unanticipated and may lead to more complication than simplicity.
That's absolutely right.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? I don't see any other questions. I want to thank Representative Eastman. Did you have another question?
Well, I've got one, and I don't know if it has an answer. I'd like to throw it out there.
Yeah, go ahead. I was going
to
thank
you. Feel free to tell me it doesn't have an answer. That's always an acceptable response. But I'm trying to find out, is there a recommended way to deal in statute with the issues we deal up with Rape Shield on the one hand and the issue I raised a moment ago dealing with, you know, there are, you know, the act at issue. So the act at issue is going to be different, you know, in different circumstances, different situations, different days and so forth. And so we have the Rape Shield on the one hand, which is sort of limiting our ability to look at certain information. We're saying that's not appropriate for the context. But we also are in the reality of having to deal with the conduct at issue, which is then missing context because we've decided that context is not to be brought into the conversation. And as a lawmaker, I'm trying to figure out how to set the limit at what is the appropriate information to bring into the context as we're dealing with conduct at issue, as we're dealing with implied circumstances, implied threats. And it seems to me, you know, kind of as a non-attorney perhaps, that we're trying to do two competing and totally opposing things. We're trying to say that it's all contextual, and then we're also saying, but not this context. And I see the tension there, and I'm wondering, does the bill, in your view, does it strike a good balance on that tension, or is there other ways that you've also seen that are helpful of dealing with that tension?
So I do not know Alaska's Rape Shield law. I do know that under the federal rules of evidence, even with a Rape Shield statute, you are allowed to introduce evidence of past conduct with the particular defendant. So if there's a sort of pattern or practice between two people in terms of how they have sex that informs whether or not there's consent or a threat in that particular case that would be admissible, at least under the federal rules. So I don't know whether Alaska has that now or doesn't have that now, but that's certainly one way to ease some of that tension. I mean, there's certainly, you know, questions about, I could go on for 15 minutes on sort of rape shield laws and how they in some ways are protective of victims and in other ways sort of, you know, basically solidify that, you know, women are supposed to be these sort of asexual, chaste, virginal beings. And, you know, it would have been better to have a world where it said, you know, how people have had sex is really has no bearing on this particular instance of consent than the fact that we sort of tell juries to pretend like victims aren't otherwise sexual agents. It has some difficult ramifications in some particular kinds of cases. But I think for your particular question, merely allowing defendants to introduce evidence of past conduct with victims is going to alleviate some of the tension you're particularly worried about. And that may be true in Alaska's law. I just don't know that off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, Professor Berzin, I want to thank you very much for taking time from your other commitments with the university to come and testify all the way across the country with us. And I want to thank you on behalf of the committee for taking the time to share your background and experience and expertise on this. And we are going to hold this bill for further review. As I think I announced at our prior meeting, amendments for House Bill 50, House Bill 5 are due at 5 p.m. tomorrow electronically to my office. Again, thank you very much, Professor.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
And our second and final order of business today is Senate Bill 161, Political Party Definition, sponsored by Senator Wilikowski. I think we'll keep his office on the way. Yeah, okay. This is the second hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Members of this committee expressed interest in an amendment that would undo the amendment adopted by the House State Affairs Committee. However, after doing research, an identical version of a bill cannot be introduced as a new version of the same bill. So rather, in this case, our committee has been advised to adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 161, version B, as the committee's working document. And for those of us that serve on State Affairs Committee, this would be the working document that we started with in the State Affairs Committee before I think all three of us that serve on state, actually all four of us that serve on state affairs, one of whom is not here, we all supported this amendment. And what we discovered was that similar language appears four or five other places in statute. And I think Senator Wilikowski had expressed preference then rather than trying to amend the other four or five other places in statute, we should just go back to the B version as our working document. And I did speak with Representative Eastman, who had sponsored that amendment in State Affairs, and I think I'm accurately representing his perspective that he's comfortable returning to the B version. So, Representative Drummond, could I have a motion?
You bet, Mr. Chair. I move that the House Judiciary Committee adopt the committee substitute to Senate Bill 161, version 32-LS1361/B as in boy, as our working document.
And hearing no objections, then the committee adopts the committee substitute for Senate Bill 161, version B, as our working document. That brings us the bill back before the committee. We had asked for amendments, and we didn't receive any, but Representative Eastman came to me before the committee today to have proceed with it as a conceptual amendment, at least for some discussion. And I understand Senator Wilikowski is receptive to having the discussion about the conceptual amendment. So I'm going to, late in the session, relax my usual rigid standards for not taking up anything that wasn't filed on time. And Representative Eastman, if you want to distribute the proposed amendment, and then Senator Wilikowski, if you want to come forward, and we can have some discussion about Senate Representative Eastman's conceptual amendment, and we'll take it from there.
Thank you. And while the amendments are being circulated, this is a short amendment. It's I.3 on the title. I don't believe that that is going to be impacted by the CS that we just adopted. And the language on the amendment simply deals with the definition of political party. It doesn't change the 5,000 registered voters. It just clarifies what we are actually saying there. And, so I'll move for discussion amendment I.3. Hopefully everyone has a copy by now.
And I'll object for discussion. Or I'll object, not just for discussion. I'll object.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman. Oh, Representative Vance.
Thank you. Through the chair, on this, the very first word is members who declared. Would you define members?
Yes. In fact, that is the definition here in the amendment. And it is defining members as those who have declared an affiliation with the organized group when registering to vote, which is my understanding. That is actually the legal effect of our current statute. And I wanted to, I understand that there was some research done on that topic, and I also understand that the sponsor had something to say on that. I wanted to invite your response both to the amendments and to the underlying legal significance were we to adopt it.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Wilkowski, State Senator representing East Anchorage and Jaybird, joined by David Dunsmore and my staff. And through the chair, Representative Eastman did bring this issue to my attention. We were certainly concerned about what we were hearing about it. And we did some research on this. And so I guess the concern was that a political party could unilaterally decide not to have someone's political party placed next to their name on a ballot. And so we looked at the statute at AS 1515030, and we contacted legislative legal and just verified. And if I could read the statute, it's, as I just said, section 5, it says, if a candidate is registered as affiliated with a political party or a political group, the party affiliation, if any, may be designated after the name of the candidate upon request of the candidate. So the candidate is the one who decides what political party shall be on the ballot. If you're a registered Democrat, you can have registered Democrat on there. If you're a registered Republican, you can have a registered Republican on there. The party doesn't get to decide whether you're on what you're listed as. You have, and we verified that with legislative legal, and there's a freedom of association issue. And so I think based on that, we don't need the amendment. I think the issue is an important one and important to clarify. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vance, looks like you have a follow-up question.
I do. I like the definition, but the word members, I know it was a discussion because of parties wanting to determine their own membership. And I think there is a kind of a contention right now that is seeking to be resolved of who gets to determine that label. And so for clarification, if we adopt this amendment as the legal interpretation that you have is that the candidate gets to determine the party, not the organization. Is that correct?
Yes, through the chair. We think that is existing law. We think that is what the current law says. So I guess my position would be you don't need this amendment. That's the position that we have in our discussion with legislative legal. They've indicated the same thing, that a party cannot decide whether or not a party can't have a test, I guess, or some, can't have some sort of process where they say, we don't really believe you're a libertarian or a Democrat or a Republican. Whatever you register as is what goes on the ballot. You as the candidate, whatever any candidate decides, person decides they want to register as a libertarian, they register as a libertarian, they're on the ballot as a libertarian. That's the way it is.
And Representative Eastman, as to this conceptual amendment, does this amendment change, if that's the law, does this change that law in any way, or would it still be, if if I'm registered as a Democrat today, if I want to go down and register as a Republican tomorrow, I could do that, and then on the next ballot I would be registered as a Republican or listed as a Republican. Does this amendment change that structure at all?
No, I don't believe so, and I'm leaning in the direction that the amendment is not actually needed. I think there was a question before we worked with others to draft the amendment over whether or not the definition of member in statute or not in certain statutes, sort of opens the door to the definition of party or an action a candidate might take on a ballot, for example. And I think the answer that we got back pretty conclusively was that the current statute would need to change in order for that to happen. And this change actually wouldn't accomplish that. The definition of party, 5,000 registered voters. The question originally was, well, does that mean 5,000 members? Is a registered voter the same as a member? Effectively, I think the answer that I've come to is that in our current statute, barring some new piece of legislation, a registered voter is considered a member of a party, and the idea that we could affect positively or negatively ballot access by redefining member, I don't think that avenue is available to us under the current regime statute.
Representative Kirkner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at this language and I'm thinking, and it could be somewhere else in a different statute. But it's my understanding that the current process with the Division of Elections is that when you register to vote, you declare what political affiliation you want.
Or none.
Well, that would still be declaring what you want. And if you're declaring with an organization or a group, what we're calling it, that does not have that threshold in your bill, you're raising it to five, I think lowering it to 5,000, I think. Senator Wilkowski, I'm kind of wondering if the language of the amendment actually makes more sense, because they're not officially recognized parties yet if they're below that threshold. You're declaring an affiliation with an organized group. Not necessarily a party, because some of these parties don't exist yet, because they're still under that threshold. Does that make sense?
Thank you, Representative Kirker, through the chair. And I'll turn to my staffer, who knows this much better than I do. The statute right now, again, this is partially because of ballot measure two, I guess in large part because of ballot measure two, says if a candidate is registered as affiliated with a political party or political group. So we have various political parties, we have various political groups. This bill would say, would change or make it easier, I think, because it lowers the threshold for a party to be recognized. The party affiliation, if any, may be designated after the name of the candidate upon request of the candidate. So again, if whatever you register as under existing law is what is placed on the ballot, unless you say otherwise. If you're undeclared, it says undeclared. If you're a Republican, it says Republican, et cetera, et cetera. I guess just getting into the technicalities of this amendment as it's written, I think this was an attempt to clarify. It is using a different term. It talks about an organized group when the statute talks about a political party or political group. So I think you get into a little bit of definitional issues there. I don't think you need the amendment, because I think what it's trying to accomplish is already accomplished in law.
Thank you.
So there is an objection to the amendment, Representative Easton?
Yeah, and I'm all for clarity and always looking for better ways to clarify, but I don't know that this is going to have any legal impact, so I'll withdraw the conceptual amendment. Appreciate the discussion from members.
So conceptual amendment number one is withdrawn. We have no other conceptual amendments. That brings the bill back before us for comments. Actually, take a brief at ease. Back on record, that brings us back for final comments. And as is my practice, is 3 minutes per member. Representative Christ Thompson is not with us, nor Representative Snyder. So, Representative Drummond, you're up first if you want to have any comments.
I'm fine with the bill the way it is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vance. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. You know, there were some discussions that some members of us had in the previous committee, and I know that didn't include every member of the committee, but I wanted to just refresh for those who weren't in state affairs. We did discuss whether or not the 5,000 registered voters was the appropriate threshold. I could see, given ballot measure 2, given the way that the current special election has come together and the long list of candidates that are going to be appearing on that ballot next month, I could see that we could reduce that threshold substantially and perhaps make the playing field a little bit more equitable. I think that was one of the purposes behind the bill, was to make a more equitable playing field between the different political groups and political parties. Of course, political groups are competing for that party status. I'll also say, I think, 5 years ago, this bill would have been a very contentious one, perhaps, because there was a lot at stake. But now, because candidates, are basically able to define or decide their own affiliation on the ballot, and the party is much less in control of that process after the passage of ballot measure 2, whether you like that or dislike that. I know I have a lot of constituents who really dislike that. But the fact that it's at 5,000 or was down to, I think one of the proposals was somewhere closer to 250, I don't know that a lot of Alaskans would really know the difference, because the ballot access was sort of the main value to being a political party in the minds of many voters. And with that not as important, I think 5,000 is an improvement, but I don't know that there's going to be a lot of Alaskans that notice when this bill passes. No disrespect to the bill sponsor, and I appreciate that there is some good being done by it.
Thank you. Representative Kirker. Comments?
I'm good.
I have no comments either. So that brings us to Representative Drummond. May I have a motion?
Sorry. Mr. Chair, I move version 32-LS1361-B of Senate Bill 161 with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Hearing no objection, Senate Bill 161 moves from committee. Please stay behind to sign the paper. And that, just a brief at ease. On record. And we will now recess for the day and reconvene on Friday, May 6th at 10:30 a.m. And with that, we stand in recess.